Hey, I'm Zach, and one day I'm going to make movies, but right now I'm young, dumb, and not nearly as good-looking as my co-hosts. So with the help of...
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
I'm Steven.
I'm going to learn what makes a movie great by watching all the classics I have skipped over. So pop the corn and turn your cell phone to silent, because it's time for a new episode of Zach on Film. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another exciting episode of Zach on Film, Episode 2, as we take a look at The Great Escape.
Great Escape, 1963, I want to say.
That sounds about right.
Yes, 1963. Yep. I'm looking at it. Yeah.
50 years ago.
Ooh.
Oh, 50 years, yeah.
It is the 50th anniversary. I got a little story about that coming up. Zach, give us a rundown then of The Great Escape, directed by John Sturges.
Mm-hmm.
And starring Steve McQueen, James Garner, Richard Attenborough as the top leads on that.
Right, so The Great Escape is about POWs from World War II, from many different nations, have all been clumped together, and they are being put in this new POW camp that the Germans have made. And it's all about their scheming, because these are a lot of these people have made multiple escape attempts, because it is their duty as ranking officials in their armies to try to cause as much problems for the Germans as possible, so they escape multiple times. And so now they're making a giant, or a great, if you will, scheme to break somewhere up. I think the plan is to escape 250 people mm-hmm. out of this POW camp, and then the whole film is just about them making preparations to pull off this great escape.
So, a couple of things. This is based on true story,
mm-hmm.
okay? Although some of the facts are changed.
Right.
And this is one of the problems with adaptation, is that there's no way with the 250 people in the POW camp that you're going to be able to highlight everyone and their role in the escape.
Yeah.
Right? So, we start to take little aspects of characters and we merge them into one. The James Garner character, the Scrounger, is actually a composite of like three different people, I believe.
Oh, okay.
The mole, the guy that tries to climb over the fence and gets shot.
Right.
His character is the actual character. Everything that we saw about him, that is what mm-hmm. happened to that real life person. Big X, played by Richard Attenborough, mm-hmm. is also based on a single person. But in adaptation, we see that things get changed a little bit. The other thing that happens in adaptation is, especially when you're doing something like a movie, is sometimes you make changes for commercial appeal.
Mm-hmm.
So who is this ideally targeted towards? Or who is this targeted towards, this movie? It was released in the United States.
I'm going to go with Americans.
Okay, so it's released in Americans.
Yeah.
And who are kind of the three big central characters that we see in this movie? Well, two, I guess, but there's a third that keeps popping mm-hmm. up. Who are they? You got Steve McQueen.
Yes.
And James Garner.
Yep.
And the one that keeps throwing James Garner the ball every time he goes into the cooler. Or not James Garner, the Steve McQueen,
uh-huh.
the ball. Those are three Americans.
Okay. Yeah.
In real life, the Americans started helping out in the initial stages of the big escape and digging the tunnel. Mm-hmm. But before anybody could escape, they were transferred to another camp.
Oh, okay.
So for commercial appeal purposes, we are taking amalgams of a bunch of different characters from a bunch of different nationalities, most of them British, mm-hmm. and turning them into Americans, so that as we see Steve McQueen trying to escape, go America, you know, kind of
right,
stuff.
Right.
James Garner and his plight or flight, we can root for or identify with the Americans, mm-hmm. right? So that's kind of some things that happen as far as the story goes, as we're taking it from a book based on real facts and turning it into a commercial product to sell to movie theaters. Mm-hmm. Most of the people involved in The Great Escape were all British. But what we find 50 years later is that The Great Escape is still aired every year in Great Britain around Christmas time, mm-hmm. because it's such a big popular movie that people still want to see it. Now, that being said,
mm-hmm.
what did you think of The Great Escape?
Wasn't in my mind so great.
Why?
The so-so escape at best.
Yeah, definitely. It's meh.
Why? Why was it meh?
Well, it was, I thought, way too long.
Okay.
The camera shots were the exact same thing through the entire movie. I got about halfway through, and I was just yelling, do something besides a medium.
Right.
Please stop shooting at eye level.
Right.
And I thought the tone of the movie was not definitely what I expected. I was like, it's a great escape movie.
Mm-hmm.
Very suspenseful. Mm-hmm. And
but what's suspenseful? They could get caught at any moment.
I didn't, but here's the problem. They can get caught at any moment, and what do? They don't die. They've escaped 17 times, and they're still just putting them in camps. Like, what's the point? Just keep escaping. Well, they're not going to do anything.
Well, but they're disrupting things behind the lines, right? So the Reich can't afford to have them behind enemy lines mucking things up. So they have to put them together, and because they're putting them in separate camps, and they constantly get out of that, you know, that's causing more troubles for them financially.
Right.
So the Reich decides, let's put all of these brilliant minds in
together.
One location and hope that they stay there, Schultz.
Right.
So, but I can see where it, I can see where you're coming from.
And it wasn't just in the fact that, oh, if they try to escape, they're going to come back and they might get the one guy or initially the two guys that are escaping get put into some little isolation chamber for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But the tone through the music conveys is like, it would be kind of dramatic to a sense, but then you always have this like light dainty music playing. Like, well, this isn't suspenseful at all. It's it hinges like on a comedy and drama suspense thing, and it never really solidifies what it really is.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought that kind of threw the whole thing off.
Rodrigo, you want to touch on any of the three things that Zach's brought up? Too slow,
sure.
Medium shots, or too long, medium shots, and can't decide where it wants to go as far as a story.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can run through all three of those.
Okay. Let's pick pace first, the length.
It is too long. Well, the reason why it's too long is because it's actually two different movies.
Mm-hmm.
You start out with a movie about a bunch of guys trying to break out of a prison camp. And then follows up to basically a movie about a bunch of guys out in Germany trying to elude the authorities.
And I think that goes for like 35, 40
minutes.
50 minutes of the after the escape.
Okay. I'm like, this should be almost done.
Yeah.
Move my mouse to see much time.
It's funny because I just rewatched this the other night because I'm like, I want to be fresh. It's been probably about 8 or 9 years since I've watched this movie. And I kind of got in that same part where I was like, my God, this should be over by now. This is, you know, I know what happens next. He gets shot, plane crashes, he gets killed, they get shot, boom, the end. But you're right, it does drag that on for quite some time. What else, Rodrigo? Anything else about this length?
That's the biggest part of it is that everything that they hit on, it happens multiple times. So it's like, it's not like, oh, we have hit a snag with the tunnel. It's, we hit a snag with the tunnel, they fix it. We hit another snag with the tunnel, they fix it. They hit another snag with the tunnel, they fix it. We see three different times, you know, we established, I think, twice that Steve McQueen's character gets put in the cooler before the last time he gets put in the cooler, which is actually, before the time when it actually makes sense plot-wise for him to end up in the cooler, or rather that it's important to the plot that he ends up in the cooler.
Right.
See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like, he could have been introduced at that moment, at the moment where the British guys are like, well, we need surveillance outside. Boom. Here's Steve McQueen's character. Right. Hey guys, I'm going to go outside. Okay. You go do it. You get caught. I'm not doing it. Do it. All right. I'm doing it. Okay, cool.
Part of that is because, the mole got killed, and that was the breaking point for him to say, okay, I'll do that.
Right.
Matthew, when was the last time you watched, not Zach on film, when was the last time you watched The Great Escape?
Trying to remember. Probably would have been sometime in the 90s.
Oh, so a long time for you. What are your big takeaways from the movie? What did you remember most or like or not like about that movie?
motorcycle jumps are awesome.
Yeah, now
that was cool.
Steve McQueen doing all but the final jump in that movie. He does all his own stunt work, so all but the final jump. Steve McQueen also impersonates one of the Nazis who's riding the motorcycles because he had the motorcycle experience and background. So I think that's kind of cool.
So bringing
when the chicken jumped too,
We'll talk about that in a little while.
Bringing up the motorcycle chase, as I'm watching The Great Escape, and I'm thinking, why in the world am I watching this? Because it's not that good. I Google it. I'm like, why is this? They think and then someone talked about, the motorcycle chase is a great scene, and so that's coming up. I'm like, okay, I'll watch this. It'll be really cool. And then we get to the motorcycle chase, and they're like, it's such great stunt work. I was like, well, let's watch it. Oh, so he's just gonna ride up a hill for 15 seconds. Okay. He's just riding down that hill
again.
Oh, and then he did the big jump
again. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind, this is 1963.
Right.
So you got to keep the time period. This is before this Matthew, who's the big stunt man that Burt Reynolds played in his biography movie.
Gator.
Is that his name?
Sharky.
Yeah.
The bandit.
The thing is that this is before you're doing the thing where you can drop a guy 50 stories on a thin wire and have him safe. This is before Evel Knievel rises to fame.
Mm-hmm.
So when you see, and especially an actor, which is even today seldom, Harrison Ford did a lot of his own stunts. Yeah, for an actor to be doing all that quote unquote stunt riding is kind of impressive. So as you approach this, you kind of keep in mind the time period part of that.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying, but the again, it goes back to a lot of camera choices and editing.
Let's talk camera choices.
That's why I didn't think the thing was a bit.
I thought a lot about this, and I had to do some research on John Sturges for this.
Okay.
By the time we hit The Great Escape, 1963, Sturges only has 8 more movies left in him, all of them produced within the decade. 78, I think, is his last one. The Eagle Has Landed.
Okay.
So the bulk of his work was pre-1963. Now, he already did The Magnificent Seven that we did, but his first film was in 1946.
Yeah.
Okay. Right at the time World War II was in full swing, the United States has entered the war, but we still want movies. We, as Americans, still need to be entertained. And during World War II, plastics were rare. You didn't have, not rare, but it was a commodity that you were using for the war effort, and so you didn't have a lot to waste. And so one of the big things that gets drilled into people's minds starting around World War II, and then even progressing as anamorphic lenses, CinemaScope starts to come in, is that try to get as much as you can in a two-shot or a three-shot, and not so much in close-ups. And I have a feeling, and I haven't seen a lot of Sturges' other films, but I have a feeling that studio method of turning out movies was ingrained in him at his young age, and that style still continues all the way into the future. Because we saw a lot of that, too, in Magnificent Seven, where there was a lot of two shots, three shots, four shots. A lot of that, too, is so that all the characters have time on the screen. You know, you're not cutting to singles so that you're focusing on just James Garner or just Richard Attenborough or just, Charles Bronson. Or, I'm at a loss for names, of the other ensemble cast that's in there. So you're
James
trying to get James Coburn. That's who I'm thinking plays in the Australian. And actually the Australians had a bigger role in the escape than any other POW country represented in that. So I think, and Rodrigo, maybe you have some more information. I think that Hollywood style was ingrained in him from the early 40s or from the mid 40s,
right,
all the way through the traditional 50s Hollywood. This is how we produce a movie. And here's how we crank out stuff on a very rapid basis into more of a let's tell a craft story kind of method.
Oh, absolutely. If I was going to talk about the production of The Great Escape and summarize it in one word, I would say economical.
Yeah.
Okay.
They did
all
shoot
of the
this
shots.
Go ahead.
All of the shots are very static. All of the, there are very few like shot, reverse shot things going. You can tell there are some scenes where people step over each other's lines and they just play it off and they keep going. You know, they weren't doing too many takes on this.
Yeah. Now, this was made for, in the day, $4 million. I'm going to imagine a bulk of that money went to Steve McQueen, Richard Attenborough, and James Garner. As you watch in the credits, they're the three names that appear before the title of the movie. Mm-hmm. They're the big stars. This was also shot in Germany, in Bavaria, near the studio that they shot at. So they actually built this concentration camp, all the interiors and everything, just outside the studio lot in a forest. So a bulk of that could go to there because you're going to have to build a whole POW camp.
Pretty big camp.
And be able to shoot inside and outside and shoot your underground scenes and all that. So I can imagine a bulk of the money went into those three areas. So when it comes to lighting, when it comes to camera choices, you don't have a lot of choices in that. So in regards to your question about or your concern about not going in for the close-ups that much, I think that's your answer, is look at how the director, look at his past work leading up to that, and that might give you some indication. And I think economics is probably the biggest answer. Anything else, Rodrigo, that you want to add to that comment about the long static shots?
No, I think that's about it. Interestingly, though, it's like the storytelling of it is the opposite. The storytelling of it is long and involved. While the shots are kind of like static and very Spartan.
I think one of the biggest complaints when this movie came out originally was that you've got a really long movie, but you don't have a chance to really go into depth with a lot of characters. And I kind of take issue a little bit with that because you do find out what is driving the characters. I keep wanting to call him Jives, but the mole character.
Ives
hates being isolated. Even though he's a tunneler, you can tell being isolated, being in the cooler for that long had a psychological impact on him. And when they find out that the tunnel has been discovered, he's got no other choice but to kill himself. I cannot take this anymore. Some of these guys have been in the camps for 3+ years. I think the Steve McQueen character, we don't find a lot about. I mean, there's a couple character reveals that he was in school
for backstory.
Yeah, he really is. James Garner character as the scrounger. We don't also learn a lot about him, but the forger, you know, here's this guy who's doing a bulk of the work to create documents. And then right at the end of the film, he goes blind from all this work. And now granted, this is compressed time. You're taking something that took place over a couple of years and squeezing it into a couple of months. But here he goes blind. And how terrible is that? You got the Russian who suddenly reveals that the reason why he's trying to escape is because he's claustrophobic. And every time he goes down into the tunnels, it bothers him. So I think there was character development, right, Rodrigo, or not? Am I misreading that?
No, there was a lot.
There really is. You know, that is also very economical, but definitely in a good way. I mean, you get into things where it's like, you see that, what's the other guy's name? The other British guy that tries to escape with McDonald, I think.
Yeah, McDonald. He
goes over to Ives and kind of has a little thing because I think I don't know if they're both supposed to be Scottish or McDonald just comes from a Scottish family. I don't know. I mean, McDonald is a Scottish name.
Right.
So they have a little thing. It's like, oh, it's the Scotsmen doing their thing. Well, the Americans are doing their thing. Look, everybody's kind of hanging out. And, you know, for example, James Gardner's character, you know, you don't find out a lot about him when this happens. But the moment that the forger goes blind, he steps up. You know, his character development comes from this other character that's having problems. Then you get to find out what sort of man, what sort of like nice, take care of his friends, lantern jawed, beautiful man he is.
Yeah. Okay, so here is an unintended consequence of being a James Garner fan. As a kid, I was first introduced to this guy at my grandparents' house when I was watching the Rockford Files. I didn't start out with what was the series, Matthew, that he was in, the Western?
James Garner?
Yeah.
Maverick.
I was never introduced to him through Maverick, but I was through the Rockford Files. And in the Rockford Files, James Garner was a Korean War veteran. That was his character. And in the Jim Rockford's backstory was that of a scrounger. So the first time that I sit down and watch The Great Escape and he playing a scrounger, from that point on, every time I watch the Rockford Files and he mentions how he was a scrounger in the war, all I can think about is The Great Escape.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, and I didn't find this out until, I don't know, about a year or so ago, James Garner was in the Korean War, and he actually was a scrounger in the Korean War. So it's just this weird kind of thing that that goes on. So I think from a kind of a story point, your third point of, you know, where is the plot? Is it a comedy? Is it a tragedy or whatever? It's a movie of what is the human spirit willing to do in order to survive? They know that it's their duty to escape, that no matter what, they have to escape. Mm-hmm. And they know, especially for Big X, Attenborough's character, that if he gets out, the Gestapo is just going to kill him. They've already made that. When they dropped him off at the camp, they're like, if you ever escape again, you're dead.
Mm-hmm.
And he wants to just continue to do that. And so there's this thing of human spirit, of it's man against the elements, in this case, Earth, and can we get out of this? It's not against the Germans. It's can we get out of this situation that we have been placed in? And I think that's kind of where the drama comes from, is can they do it? Will they do it? How are they going to do it? To dig as far as they have to dig, as they say in the movie, is one of the long 100 yards, a football field length that they have to dig. Now, they end up coming short by about 20 yards, which kind of plays a big part in that movie.
Yeah.
But I mean, this idea of we have to tunnel 100 yards to get out, to save our lives, to do what we need to do, I think it becomes a human spirit kind of thing. And rah, rah, look at us. Yes, we're still defeating the Germans in the process just by escaping.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Zach, before we get into this next section, I think it's time that we thank people who have contributed to the Major Spoilers cause, people who help make this very show possible. Matthew, who do we got?
Okay. Zatch on Phlegm number 2 is brought to you by Kevin Hall, Ahmad Abed El Aziz, Douglas Hopkins, Oscar Rodriguez, Jeffrey Arbo, Nathan Olson, Sean Brown, Paul Wade, Peter Wilker, Michael Watanabe.
What else? Go on. What else either bothered you or things that you liked? Was there anything in the piece that you liked?
Oh, yeah, certainly. I like the characters a lot. The even though I brought issues with the story at large, I thought some of the characters were, I mean, most of the characters were enjoyable to just watch on screen, and you could feel the pain of the forger when he realizes he's going blind, and he's trying to set up a little skit to show that he can still see, and he obviously can say, well...
So you're a big Seinfeld fan.
Oh, yeah.
Remember George Costanza did that when they're like, put on your glasses. Yeah, I can see that dime over there. He sets that up just the way that the Forger does.
Spotting possums left and right.
Yeah. That's just how he did that in this movie. Mm-hmm. So there is a, you know, there's a lot of movies and TV shows and whatever that draw inspiration from The Great Escape. Matthew had mentioned Chicken Run a little bit ago.
Oh, yeah.
And that's essentially The Great Escape, told with chickens and stop-motion animation.
Mel Gibson and a clay chicken. Top Secret has a big take on it.
Well, and then, you know, once you get into a television series, Hogan's Heroes is the parody version, I guess, if you want to call it, the comedy version of the story.
Let's not go so far as to call Hogan's Heroes a comedy.
Well, it's certainly, it's probably, farce. There we go. A farce. But it is these characters. Yeah. It is this story being told as a farce.
Right.
Val Kilmer actually does a parody of the motorcycle escape in Top Secret, where he goes over the fence and then he looks in at this camera and he gives a camera a wink and then he jumps over 5 buses. It's awesome.
So what's the good that you can get out of this? I mean, certainly when we talk night scenes, last time we were talking Day for Night with the Magnificent Seven. I keep wanting to say Seven Samurai. Yes, the Magnificent Seven Samurai. The Day for Night was very obvious in this film.
Yeah.
Here they're actually shooting at night in many scenes, except for one. Do you know which one was the Day for Night in the Great Escape?
No.
It is when they're taking off from the airfield. With the plane taking off from the airfield. That's their day for night shot. It's supposed to be
That was supposed to be an early dawn shot. Oh.
But it was supposed to be a really dark shot. But again, shadows are coming from high noon in that entire scene.
In my mind, that entire scene happened in the afternoon,
no,
I guess.
It would have been much brighter in that case. But you go back and watch it and look at how the darks are shut down and everything's supposed to be darker. The tell is the fact that you cut away to the office and the lights on in the office and those guys are trying to peer out to see what's going on into the darkness. Oh, that's the tell there.
I was watching it. I was like,
this is why day for night shots fail. This is why day for night shots fail, because they look like they're the daytime and it's actually supposed to be night.
I completely thought, because everything else that was happening, it seemed, because all when they're escaping, all those stories are, I assume, were happening coincidentally. They're showing them different times. And it seemed everything was happening in the day. And so he takes out the guard and they're saying, why are they shooting him?
Yeah, yeah. Early morning, late, you know, like right before the sun rises.
Oh, okay. I totally missed that.
But there's
that
no
then.
Shadows. But the night scenes, though, where they're actually coming out of the tunnel.
Not good.
Why?
Well, obviously they were shot at night.
Right.
But
you know, when they turn off the lights of the camp?
They had still a lot of moonlight,
which is a problem because it was already established early on that the night that they are escaping is a
full moon,
a new moon. So it's going to be pitch black.
And there happened just to be like a perfect sliver of light that crossed from the trees right on top of the hole.
Now, does that bother you?
Highlight everything.
Does that bother you, Rodrigo, Matthew, Zach?
You can't take that sort of thing and use it to deconstruct a film because
we're pointing it out.
But you'll never enjoy a movie again.
Well, I don't think it didn't hurt story wise. I just said, hey, isn't that convenient? They placed that light right above the hole.
But this again is audiences are going to forgive a lot, and most people probably never would have paid any attention to that. Just like, why are they wearing their good suits while they're crawling through a dirty tunnel? Why don't they change in the forest?
Yeah.
Right? You know, that's kind of a giveaway. Rodrigo, you said you had a lot to share on this movie. Educate young Zach.
No, mostly I was just being a jerk.
Oh.
No. I do have stuff to say. And you know, this movie is another one that is mostly important because of where it the place it occupies in American culture.
Yep.
You will and have seen a lot of takeoffs of The Great Escape. You've seen them on TV, you've seen them in cartoons, and you've heard that song from The Great Escape before.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Usually on montages that of people either escaping from somewhere or being industrious about something, it has mutated to the point where it's like, now, anytime there's like a mild anti-authoritarian vibe to something, or somebody is like putting something together, or a group of people are putting something together, you hear the theme from The Great Escape.
I can't wait till we get on the bridge on the River Kwai. That's going to be awesome.
Yeah, the, you know, the
comet. It makes your mouth turn green, comet.
Well, let's wait till we get
to gasoline. I mean, the music is a really interesting study as well, because there's that theme, but that theme is an upbeat march.
Right.
So sometimes when bad things happen and you hear like the low like strings go like brrr, and they bring in the theme is they're like,
yeah, still, yeah, still flutes and piccolos.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like weirdly disjointed, but it's like, okay, again, there's this like very formulaic aspect to the movie. A, the movie has a theme. B, bad things are happening. Lower everything, then play the theme as a leitmotif. And sometimes it really just doesn't work. It feels weird.
This movie also has a super downer of an ending, right? Mm. Of the 76 that escape, most of them, 50 of them are killed.
50 of them are killed. 11 of them are bringing out, and then 12.
Three actually escape. In the real story, only 3 of them escape.
Oh, really?
And they're represented by James Coburn, Charles Bronson, and the other guy whose name I just don't remember.
I don't remember either.
But they were represented as the only three that actually made it out. Everyone else is killed. Now, they said how many are coming back in the movie, and they said, well, 11 so far. They weren't counting number 12, which was Steve McQueen's character coming back.
Right.
And so there's the missing other number like that supposedly that are coming back as well. But, yeah, they dedicate this movie to the 50.
50, right.
Cost $4 million, made $11 million in its initial release, 1963, became one of the top grossing films of that time period, of that year of 1963. It has gone on to get a much larger audience and a bunch of people that really appreciate this. And so much so that, like I mentioned, that from the last reading that I saw, that the BBC airs this every year. Kat Halo, who does a lot of our movie reviews for the Major Spoilers podcast. Listeners, you can find that at majorspoilers.com or catch it in the Major Spoilers Podcast Network master feed. You can hear his reviews there. He and his brother watch this film every year, and they love it. Really? It's one of his favorite films of all time. I like it because I think it's this, even though it has a downer ending, it's this spirit of we're going to do it. And plus it has, you know, that great music also by, this is Bernstein, who did the music for The Seven Samurai.
Oh, okay.
He also did, what else did he do? To Kill a Mockingbird, Robot Monster. He also did, the National Geographic theme song. Bum, 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 bum. So if you listen, and this is the weird thing, when you listen to Bernstein's, he does marches. When you listen to The Magnificent Seven, when you listen to The Great Escape, when you listen to the National Geographic show open, they're all the same feel, just like a Sousa march.
Mm-hmm.
Bernstein has this feel of what goes on. And I think that when we look at future composers like John Williams, I'm going to bet has to be inspired by Bernstein here.
Has to be. And Bernstein also did Animal House.
Well, and that's what we're going to get to. He also did Animal House, and that led him to do The Blues Brothers, Ghostbusters, Stripes, and Airplane.
Nice.
So when we look at music and we look at someone who's done a lot of music that has these marching type things, you know, Bernstein's there. Just like John Williams, you associate him with Lucas and Spielberg as far as composers go. What are you going to take away from this, Zach? What are you going to take away from The Great Escape? Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's not going to sit high on your favorite list, although it does have, I think it does have a lot of big, important things that still resonate today in films. Not just the homages to, but techniques for doing these kind of things. How do we do a chase scene? How do we do a story where there's people confined into a small space?
Mm-hmm.
But what are you going to take away?
Story-wise, I think the character interactions were really well and worked really well. They were able to take characters from different places and still like mingle them with their different personalities and stuff. So story character wise, it was good. A takeaway from my negatives to turn into a positive. I think that in today's film culture, you can't really get away with a movie shot like this is shot. And that take that to an economic point. Like Rodrigo said, that filmmaking is so cheap now that you can reshoot things and try different angles and get really cheap cameras and throw them on a motorcycle. Shoot the wheel and stuff.
Who's one of your favorite current directors, or says he's not directing anymore?
Kevin Smith.
Go back and watch Clerks.
Oh, I know. I know.
And tell me that that's not shot on an economical budget of mostly two shot medium shots.
It is
throughout the entire piece.
Then he made Red State.
Yep.
So,
but again, there is a. Some budget issues there. On
right, again. Red State is limited in what it does.
Yeah. So it's character. Tell some good character stories.
Sure.
We're not looking at crane shot after crane shot there, neither.
Right. Matthew, what are we looking at as far as giving Zach a pass on this?
Well, the thing about it, and the thing that is very important, Rodrigo nailed it on the head. The Great Escape is as important for what it represents and the role that it plays, its place in history, as it is actually as a film. I don't remember ever thinking that this was a super awesome, super wonderful film. Yeah, I mean, it's not necessarily Hondo. Had he tried any of this attitude on Hondo, I would have smacked him. Is Hondo on the list?
Not on this revised list. That
let's put Hondo on the list. It's
not
3D.
That ran from 200 down to 100.
No, you'll like it. It's in 3D. But I think that to some degree we are all looking at this from the perspective of our previous expectations, and Zach's bias may be giving him a different expectation of movies than necessarily. Everybody has a bias.
Oh yeah, I love this film.
I don't mean that as a big kick in the face, but
this certainly isn't in my top 10 films, but this is certainly in my top 50 movies.
Yeah, and if it's on TV, I'd sit and watch it, unless, you know, maybe Paranormal Activity was on the next channel up, because I can't turn down Paranormal Activity. It's one of the five movies that I never turn away from. But I think maybe Zach is judging it a little bit more harshly than I would have. Maybe not even so much harshly as, again, you know, bias has a negative connotation.
Sure.
I think there's a dismissiveness there, and I don't mean that as a terrible negative of Zach's all like, whatever, whatever, well, I do what I want.
So,
but I think that
he does, though. He does do what he wants.
I do.
He snaps his fingers and shakes his head side to side, too. Mm-mm.
But I think that what it really comes down to is that Zach's expectations for a movie are not met by the basic structure and craft here. And so it's difficult. It is difficult to get past that when you're looking at something. I mean, we read a comic book a couple of weeks ago on the MSP that read backwards, drove me up the wall.
Yeah.
No matter how wonderful that book was, I'm sitting here going, damn it, I'm reading backwards.
I know where Zach is coming from, because I teach in a video production at a university. And every year in this advanced video production class, we get into aesthetics. Mm-hmm. And I start things off by saying, how many of you have watched a movie called Citizen Kane? And nobody raises their hand, obviously, because they've never. Why would I watch something that's old?
It's black and white.
Black and white and old.
That guy's dead.
He's fat and dead. Drunk, fat, and dead. But one of the things that I try to get across, and again, part of the reason why this list was created was because you watch something like Citizen Kane, or you watch something like The Great Escape, and you want to just say, this is slow and plotting and boring and blah, 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 blah. I can watch CSI Miami tonight, and it's got more interesting things in it than The Great Escape does. And you're right, but you have to think of the time period in which this is created and what was going on in the production process of that time. And I still think that this is a really, really solid movie, but I can see where you're coming from. But today I had to have the talk with why it's important to watch older films so you have that appreciation of what comes forward
and
what comes from it.
And I knew that watching it, and I said, and I was just thinking, because
that's fine. You don't have to like it. I'm not saying you have to like it.
No, but I don't want anyone to think I'm not liking it just because it's old. And the reason I didn't like it was because even like Citizen Kane, how many years was Citizen Kane before this movie?
Oh, a lot.
A lot.
Yeah.
And I was saying, I was watching, it's like, did this guy never watch Citizen Kane? Because that guy showed some ceilings and stuff. I mean, he moved the camera around. He showed different angles. It wasn't flat angles all the time.
The production process. Go back and look at another. So here's another thing that's kind of extra credit assignment for you. Go back and find another film. Matthew, look this up as I'm talking. Okay. Go back and find another film from 1963. Go look at the top 10 movies from 1963, Matthew. Go back and look at another movie from 1963.
Okay.
And I bet your arguments are going to be pretty much the same.
Same.
You know, because at this point you're hitting in this Hollywood system of editing, a Hollywood system of shooting, a Hollywood system of lighting.
There's a Hollywood standard. There's a way that a Hollywood movie looks.
Even Alfred Hitchcock, who people are like, oh, one of the greatest filmmakers of all time. Go and watch
The Birds came out in 63.
Okay, so go and watch The Birds.
Okay.
You're going to see he follows conventional editing style as he tells his story. Wide establishing shot. Medium shot, close-up shot, shot, reverse shot. And he'll go and follow that pattern in a lot of his films. To the point where today with editing, we will see a man get out of a cabin, we'll see him go into the building, and then the next shot that we see, he's entering the 34th floor office.
Right.
Back in 1963, you would go from the car to the building entrance, through
the
lobby,
to the
elevator, out the elevator.
See him push the button.
In the secretary's office, and then into the manager's office, or the person that he's going to have a meeting with. Go watch The Birds.
Okay.
I think it's actually on the list.
Probably is.
Yeah, the birds.
It's a crazy English next.
No. We're actually not going to do the birds. Not next, but it's on the list. And a couple of, I think Psycho's on this list too, if we're talking about Hitchcock. Yeah, Psycho's on there. But go back and watch. They're following this Hollywood method of how we do a production.
Okay.
And why do we...
Nazis Must Die on the list?
Look, no. Go back and look at the studio system. Do some research on this idea of what the studio system was about. It tied into vertical integration. If you don't know what vertical integration is, we can talk about that another time. Mm-hmm. Probably more so in the 1920s when we look at It Happened One Night or something like that. But go back and do some research on that. And I think you'll see that it wasn't just Sturgis doing this. Mm-hmm. It was most filmmakers doing this at that time period, because okay. That's what you did. If you wanted to work, you know, toe the line, do what you're supposed to do. So next time, listeners, oh, I forgot to ask Rodrigo, Zach, what's your evaluation of Zach this go around?
Oh, I think he's doing well. I think that he articulated well that this is a classic movie that is important to the American aesthetic that he just doesn't like.
Yeah, yeah. And that is totally fine.
Actually, this was the first time right before the show or, you know, like in preparation for the show, this is the first time that I had ever seen The Great Escape.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Not even in your snooty film school did you watch it?
No, we didn't get around to that. I was surprised at how much I liked it. Like, I was expecting this to be like, oh, super important movie, very important to the American aesthetic, super boring. But all of the little character bits really kept me interested pretty much until the, I guess, halfway point where the second movie starts.
Right, right. And again, because it'd been years since I watched it, in my mind, that last 45 minutes or 50 minutes was compressed into like 10 minutes. They get on the plane, they get in the plane, it crashes, he dies, he gets shot. The other one, they're at the train station, they get shot. You know, mm-hmm. I was blown away by how much longer that was. Mm-hmm. So I've been trying to find some connections between the last couple of Zach's films that we watched. Obviously, we went from Great Escape back to Magnificent Seven. That was inspired by some talk on Pulp Fiction and Enter the Dragon.
Right.
But this time I'm going to follow the musical trail. Mm-hmm. And we're going to follow Bernstein all the way to a movie called Animal House by John Landis. Okay, you ready for
all
that,
right,
Zach?
Yeah, I'm excited.
All right, Zach, take us out.
All right, everyone, thanks for another stopping by another week of Zach on Film. If you want to check out more, go ahead to majorspoilers.com. We have so many more podcasts you can listen to, all sorts of goodness, from two guys talking about comics to four guys talking about comics to a bunch of guys playing D&D. Everything in between. And we will see you next time.
This is your moment. Your moment to move forward and make progress. It's time to see where an education can take you. For over 130 years, Strayer University has been at the forefront of change, offering programs that help students like you get ahead and stay ahead, so you can keep striving. Visit strayer.edu to learn more. Strayer University is certified to operate in Virginia by CHEV.